RIB English Radio.
Headlines. The top EU diplomat stresses the need to, quote, use the current window of opportunity to advance toward the return of the US to the Iran deal and its full implementation. China calls on the US to put greater emphasis on dialogue instead of pressure in its policy on North Korea's nuclear weapons. Also, Israeli forces attack and injure 10 Palestinians protesting against expulsion of some inhabitants of Sheikh Jarrah district of occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, the European Union's foreign policy chief has stressed the need to seize the opportunity to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. In a tweet, Josep Borrell said he has highlighted the importance of the U.S. return to the deal and its full implementation during the first ministerial meeting of the G7. The remaining signatories to the deal have been meeting in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to find ways to salvage the nuclear accord. While substantial progress has been made in the talks, diplomats say differences still persist. Iran says it will return to full compliance with the deal only after all U.S. sanctions against Tehran are removed in a verifiable manner. Now, to discuss that story further, I'm joined by Daniel Lazar. He's an author and journalist joining us out of New York. Thank you for joining us. First, I want you to start with some comments on the tweet posted by Josep Borrell.
Well, the comments indicate that the talks are continuing. The tone of the tweet is vaguely upbeat, so therefore maybe progress is being made.
Well, the question is, still some differences persist in the talks, and do you have any idea what these differences are and if they are going to be resolved anytime soon?
The differences are immense. Basically the U.S., if the U.S. was behaving in a proper legal manner, it would rejoin the treaty, which it originally agreed to, without any preconditions whatsoever. But the U.S. is insisting on preconditions. It's not quite sure what they are, but rejoining the JCPOA. Remember, the U.S. abandoned the JCPOA unilaterally in 2018. For no good reason whatsoever. According to all the participants to the treaty was functioning fine as intended. The U.S. pulled out for no reason. And therefore, the only way to rectify that act is for the U.S. to rejoin the treaty without qualifications. But the Biden administration is raising qualifications. It is raising conditions before joining the talks. It has not reduced the economic sanctions, the punitive economic sanctions that Donald Trump imposed on Iran in May 2018. And it is also under in great pressure from its allies, Israel and Saudi Arabia, not to re-enter the deal. So those are all immense barriers towards a reactivation of the 2015 nuclear accord.
In a tweet, Josep Borrell said he has highlighted the importance of the U.S. return to the deal and its full implementation. How important do you think that tweet is and that talk between the G7 is?
It's very hard to say. There's just one statement in a long process. There are enormous barriers to be overcome. We have no idea if the negotiators will be successful. The U.S. Seems to be ambivalent about the treaty. We're not really sure. But there is a long ways to go before the treaty is reactivated.
As you said, U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018. Why do you think the U.S. Wants to return, if it does want to return?
Well, first of all, Joe Biden was part of the administration that negotiated the deal in the first place. And the deal was negotiated in 2015 between the Obama administration and Iran, and Joe Biden was the vice president at the time. So he gave his seal of approval to the JCPOA. Mm-hmm. And during his campaign, he vowed that he would re-enter the JCPOA and attacked Donald Trump for unilaterally withdrawing. But once he took office, he suddenly got cold feet and decided that maybe Donald Trump wasn't so wrong after all. So we'll see what happens.
Thank you so much for your thoughts and contribution. That was Daniel Lazar, an author and journalist, joining us out of New York. Moving on. China's UN ambassador says he hopes the U.S. will emphasize dialogue instead of pressure in its reviewed policy on North Korea. The diplomat's remark follows U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's statement that Pyongyang needs to decide whether it wants to engage diplomatically regarding the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. That's the day after North Korea lashed out at the U.S. in a series of statements, saying Washington's recent policies are proof of a hostile strategy that requires a corresponding response. Pyongyang says its nuclear program is for self-defense amid the U.S. military provocations. U.S. President Joe Biden, in his address to Congress, had said that North Korea's nuclear program poses a serious threat that will be addressed through diplomacy and stern deterrence. Political commentator Jan Williams believes the U.S. lifting of North Korea sanctions will eventually resolve years of conflict between Washington and Pyongyang. Here's more.
Certainly, the North Koreans would welcome the lifting of sanctions. And remember, in the whole case of sanctions, the sanctions are against a population which has no political influence whatsoever on Pyongyang's decisions. So they're completely unjustifiable. You know, there's a justification, say South African sanctions or even sanctions against Israel because there's an electorate you can influence and say there's a penalty for choosing your government. It's a long time since North Koreans had a say in who was ruling in the Workers' Party in Pyongyang. So the sanctions are really criminal because they're penalizing an innocent population to try to achieve the only point of sanctions is to force the people to put pressure on their government. There's no way that the North Koreans can put pressure on their government short of major insurrection. And so the sanctions are on that level. They're so broad-based that they are probably a humanitarian crime.
Journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip have marked World Press Freedom Day. The international occasion is very important for Palestinian journalists who often get attacked by Israeli soldiers in a clear violation of their right to cover the news. Ashraf Shannon has more in this report.
Palestinian journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip held a sit-in to mark World Press Freedom Day. World Press Freedom Day is observed annually around the globe on the 3rd of May as a reminder that freedom of the press is a fundamental human right. Israeli forces killed and injured hundreds of Palestinian journalists over the past two decades and haven't been held accountable for their crimes. Currently, 16 Palestinian journalists are being held in Israeli jails, including four under administrative detention. During a press conference, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate demanded an end to Israel's impunity.
Palestinian journalists are subjected to Israeli aggression, including killings and arrests almost every day, whether while they are covering the news or even inside their workplaces. Journalists are constantly threatened by Israeli forces. Such Israeli attacks and threats amount to war crimes, and we have reported these crimes to the International Criminal Court.
Israeli violence against journalists includes physical and verbal assault, as well as degrading treatment. Observers say the Israeli regime forces aim to keep journalists and mass media away from covering their crimes.
The silence of the international organizations has encouraged Israeli forces to further violate the rights of Palestinian journalists. All international press unions and syndicates must stand by Palestinian journalists and exert pressure on Israel to stop its immoral and illegal practices against journalists.
Israeli forces attacked several Palestinian media offices during the last three wars on the Gaza Strip. Since the beginning of 2020, Israeli forces carried out over 200 attacks against Palestinian journalists.
Over the past 4 months, Israeli forces carried out more than 217 violations against Palestinian journalists and media offices throughout the Palestinian territories. The attacks happened despite the protection that journalists enjoy under international law. It's crystal clear that Israeli attacks on Palestinian journalists are deliberate and systematic.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye.
On World Press Freedom Day, journalists demand international protection. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Israeli forces have violently attacked Palestinian protesters in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds, injuring at least 10 of them. The regime's forces attacked the Palestinians holding a sit-in protest in Sheikh Jarrah district against the expulsion of some inhabitants there. They also detained some protesters. An Israeli court on Sunday ruled that over a dozen Palestinian families must leave their homes until Saturday despite having lived there for generations. Palestinians see the move as part of Israel's land grab policy to expand its settlements and change the geographic character of Jerusalem al-Quds. Under international law, the Israeli judicial system has no legal authority over the population it occupies. Iraqi authorities say at least 4 rockets have hit a military airbase hosting U.S. forces north of the capital, Baghdad. Iraqi security officials said the rockets hit near the base where American contractors were bulleted. No casualties have been reported so far. There has been no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack as well. On Sunday, 2 rockets targeted an airbase at Baghdad International Airport housing U.S.-led coalition troops. Attacks on U.S. troops and their supply convoys in Iraq have increased recently amid growing anti-American sentiment there. The anti-U.S. anger grew after Washington assassinated a top Iranian general and a senior Iraqi commander near Baghdad in January last year. American civil rights activist Al Sharpton has called for an end to racism in the country, urging lawmakers to take action to stop racial profiling. Here's more.
This must stop. Enough is enough. How many funerals do we have to have before we tell the Congress and the Senate that you've got to do something in these times?
Sharpton was addressing people taking part in a funeral ceremony of Andrew Brown, an African-American killed by police. Sharpton called on law enforcement officials to release the whole tape of the police encounter with Brown. 42-year-old Brown was fatally shot during a morning raid at his home on April the 21st when local sheriff's deputies tried to serve him with search and arrest warrants. His killing in mysterious circumstances has captured national attention. The United States has been the scene of mass anti-racism protests following the death of African-American George Floyd by the hands of a white officer last year. The United States says attacks against its forces won't have any significant impact on Washington's troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby downplayed a Saturday raid on an airfield in the Afghan city of Kandahar as a, quote, small harassing attack. His remarks follow a Taliban statement that had warned foreign forces in Afghanistan of counterattacks since May the 1st. That was the original deadline for foreign troops pullout from Afghanistan under a deal reached between the Taliban and the United States in February 2020. Last month, however, U.S. President Joe Biden said his country will put an end to its longest war and proposed a September 11th deadline for a complete withdrawal from Afghanistan. Five days of violent protests against a proposed tax reform bill in Colombia have left at least 19 people dead and over 800 injured. The ombudsman's office said 16 civilians and 1 police officer died during the nationwide protest that broke out on April the 28th. The unrest forced the government of President Ivan Duque to withdraw the proposal on Monday. Duque had earlier said tax rises were necessary to respond to the economic crisis brought on by COVID-19. But the bill caused outrage among many Colombians who say they are already struggling to feed their families during the pandemic. Colombia's gross domestic product saw its sharpest crash in half a century, with the pandemic driving up unemployment rates. Activist and commentator Terry Matson says Colombian people's dissatisfaction with their government hasn't been limited to the now withdrawn tax plans.
And they've been dissatisfied for quite some time with the government. Its focus on military intervention in the region, its focus on privatization of the economy, and lack of public infrastructure, healthcare, roads, school education for the people. And so to raise taxes, and this was a value-added tax, which would have affected the price of food, petroleum, and other essentials. The people are experiencing one of the worst situations of COVID-19 in the Americas, lack of access to vaccines, and a shrinking economy on top of the pandemic shrinking the economy, and then to ask for a value-added tax, which is basically a regressive tax that affects working and middle-class people. And it was just too much to ask people, particularly now.
Dozens of civilians have been killed and some 20 others injured in a militant attack in eastern Burkina Faso. Security officials say a large number of armed individuals attacked the village of Kodiol in a Futuri district. They put a number of fatalities between 20 and 30. They added the men burst into the village and set houses on fire. Authorities say operations to secure the population and track down the assailants are underway. No group has claimed responsibility. The incident is believed to be one of the deadliest ever in the West African nation. Burkina Faso, like its neighbors, Mali and Niger, has witnessed violent insurgency since 2015. France has signed a contract to sell 30 Rafale fighter jets to Egypt in a $4.5 billion deal. It was announced by Egypt's defense ministry. President Emmanuel Macron said in December he would not make the sale of weapons to Egypt conditional on human rights, in order that he did not want to weaken what he called Cairo's ability to counter terrorism in the region. Macron's comment, however, drew criticisms, including from Human Rights Watch. The HRW director for France said that Paris, with such a deal with Cairo, is only encouraging the repression carried out by the government of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. That's your word for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Ahead of a special election on Saturday, 1st of May 2021, to replace a Texas congressman who died after contracting COVID-19, former U.S. President George W. Bush said the ascendancy of supporters of Donald Trump suggests Republicans want to be extinct. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Bush, Anglo-Saxon Ideals Show Pro-Trump Republicans Want to be Extinct. Just after a special election which was held on Saturday, 1st of May, to replace a Texas congressman who died after contracting COVID-19, the former U.S. President George W. Bush said the ascendancy of supporters of Donald Trump suggests Republicans want to be extinct. The special election was held in the 6th District of Texas, whose Republican representative Ron Wright died last February. 23 candidates competed in the election, special election, all but one of the 11 Republicans are tied to the apron strings of Donald Trump, the former president who still dominates the Republican Party. Just one candidate, the former wrestler Dan Rodimer, promises to make America Texas again and has said communists in Washington, D.C. are ruining America. Donald Trump, meanwhile, has endorsed another candidate, Susan Wright, the former congressman's widow, who the former president said last Saturday will be strong on the border issue, on crime, pro-life, our brave military and vets, and will always protect your Second Amendment. The one Republican that did not express fealty to Donald Trump, former Marine Michael Wood, told CNN he was afraid for the future of the country, given his party's adherence to Donald Trump's lie that the election was stolen, its reluctance to condemn those who rioted at the Capitol building on 6th of January in support of that lie, and the prevalence of conspiracy theories such as QAnon. Michael Wood said, I felt like I had to stand up. Somebody needed to stand up and say that this isn't what the Republican Party should be. Nonetheless, it is, according to a CNN poll released on Friday, 70% of Republicans said Joe Biden did not legitimately win enough votes to be named president. Joe Biden won more than 7 million more votes than Donald Trump and took the Electoral College 306 to Trump's 232, the same score by which Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton back in 2016. Former President George W. Bush is promoting a new book, a collection of portraits and stories of immigrants. In an interview last Friday by The Dispatch, an anti-Trump conservative podcast, he was asked about recent moves by pro-Trump extremists to form a congressional caucus promoting Anglo-Saxon traditions. George W. Bush said, to me, that basically says that we want to be extinct. If such trends continue, Bush said, in 3 to 5 years, there's not going to be a Republican Party. I mean, I read about that, and I'm saying to myself, wow, these people need to read my book. And I mean, it's like saying when I was running for governor of Texas, you'll never get any Latino votes because you're a Republican. And I said, you watch, and I worked hard. And the key thing was to let them know that I could hear their voice. I mean, democracy is great in that sense. And the idea of kind of saying you can only be Republican if, then the ultimate extension of that is it ends up being a one-person party. Asked if he agreed with more than 50% of Republicans who think the last presidential election was stolen, George W. Bush said, no, I guess I'm one of the other 50%. Bush added, by the way, I'm still a Republican, proud to be a Republican. I think Republicans will have a second chance to govern because I believe that the Biden administration is a uniting factor, particularly on the fiscal side of things. So, you know, we'll see, but I know this, that if the Republican Party stands for exclusivity, you know, used to be country clubs. Now, evidently, it's white Anglo-Saxon Protestantism. Then it's not going to win anything. Former Marine Michael Wood, the anti-Trump Texas candidate Republican, said he voted for Donald Trump in 2020, but he also said he thought the Republican Party is going to get to where I am eventually. I want that to happen without having to lose and lose and lose again. Political parties sometimes only get the message they need to try something different after a string of losses. I think we should do that now, as opposed to doing it after we lose in the midterm elections or lose another presidential election. The Texas 6th District has tended towards Democrats in recent elections, but remains unlikely to flip. Earlier this week, Donald Trump told Fox Business Channel he was 100% thinking about running in the next presidential election in 2024. Rodimer, the former wrestler who is among the top money raisers in the field of Texas, told CNN, "President Trump is still the leader of the Republican Party. I don't think he's going to go anywhere ever. I hope he doesn't. If he runs again, I'll be fired up and I'll be excited." Meanwhile, Mitt Romney was loudly booed at the Utah Republican Party convention last Saturday, 1st of May, and he was called a traitor and a communist as he tried to speak to the crowd. "Aren't you embarrassed?" the Salt Lake City Tribune reported the Utah senator asking the crowd of 2,100 delegates at the Maverick Center in West Valley City. "I'm a man who says what he means, and you know I was not a fan of our last president's character issues." Mitt Romney was the sole Republican to vote to impeach Donald Trump twice, for seeking political dirt on opponents from Ukraine and for inciting the deadly insurrection at the Capitol on 6th of January. Food for thought. Hello, dear friends, and our condolences to you all on the eve of the martyrdom anniversary of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, following the fatal sword blow he received to his head during the morning prayer in the Grand Mosque of Kufa. During his last hours, Asbagh bin Nabata, one of his companions, visited him and asked him for some words of advice. Imam Ali, peace be upon him, replied, "Oh Asbagh, what can be greater counsel than the fact that yesterday I was your companion? Today I am your guest, and tomorrow I will only be a memory."
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Subhanallah. Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah. Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of the month of Allah. In this segment, we'll be talking about famous Quran reciters in the world of Islam. One of the reciters of the Quran who's Egyptian, and probably you haven't really heard his name before, is Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Qawi. Even me, myself, I hadn't listened to his recitation before, but I listened to one of his recitations, and I really liked his recitation. This reciter, he was born in 1915 in the Sharqiya Governorate of Egypt. Okay, we could say something about Sharqiya Governorate. The style of recitation of different reciters of the Quran is sometimes relevant to the place they are born, the region where they were born and they live. Okay, the Sharqiya Governorate is an eastern governorate of Egypt. The reciters in this region recite the Quran similarly. Okay, for example, Sheikh Mahmoud Ismail Sharif was also born in Sharqiya Governorate. His recitation resembles Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Qadi, which we're talking about right now. And Sheikh Muhammad Al-Laythi was also from the Sharqiya Governorate. Or even those who were not from Sharqiya Governorate, but were close to Sharqiya Governorate, meaning the eastern governorates of Egypt, such as the Qahliya Governorate, such as where reciters such as Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar, Sheikh Abdul Samad al-Zamati, and Sheikh Hamd al-Zamil were born and raised and lived there, you will see many similarities among these reciters, because they were in the eastern part of Egypt. Likewise, in the western part of Egypt, you will see the same similarities between reciters. For example, Mustafa Ismail was in Gharbiya Governorate, the western governorate of Egypt. And Ghalwash, Sheikh Raghib Mustafa Ghalwash, was also from the western governorate. Sheikh Muhammad Abdul Aziz Hassan was also from the western governorate of Egypt. And these three reciters, they recite the Quran similarly. Their style of recitation is similar. Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Qadi, who was born in 1915, this was at a time when great reciters emerged in Egypt, such as Sheikh Mustafa Ismail, Sheikh Minshawi Abdul Basit, and all the other great reciters. Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Qadi used to recite the Quran along with these reciters in different ceremonies that were held in Egypt, in different parts of the country, and in different mosques. For example, in Lady Zainab Mosque, Sayyida Zainab Mosque, sometimes reciters would go there and recite the Quran for different ceremonies. Or in Masjid al-Imam al-Hussein, Imam Hussein Mosque, they would go there and recite the Quran. Sheikh Abdul Haq Al-Qadi is a very good reciter. This great reciter passed away in the 1990s, and many great reciters recited the Quran in his funeral, such as Sheikh Sayyid Mutawalli Abdul Al, Sheikh Muhammad Al-Laythi, and other great reciters. Now, with this introduction, let's go ahead and listen to the recitation of Surah Al-Isra, verses 13 to 14, by Sheikh عبد الحق القاضي. Let's listen and enjoy this recitation.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
And for every person, we have imposed his fate upon his neck, and we will produce for him on the day of resurrection a record which he will encounter spread open. It will be said, "Read your record. Sufficient is yourself against you this day as accountant."
The light.
Now, the 200th death anniversary of French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte has brought a unique opportunity for private collectors to buy his DNA. The auction offers Napoleon's blood-stained cloth, which is estimated to be sold for $18,000. The collection will also include a lock of the French Emperor's hair, a pair of his stockings, a shirt with an embroidered letter N, and other items of clothing.
In my opinion, Napoleon was the first to want to create a Napoleon brand, even when he was alive. He created an image, a symbol, a look, with his hat worn in reverse. It was a very ordinary hat, an ordinary coat, but he was a very good communicator, and he created his image. So generation after generation, we kept this image of Napoleon, his hat, and this contributed to the myth. But it was Napoleon who wanted from the beginning to create an image, a look.
Nearly 360 objects will go under the hammer in the upcoming auction. Many of the items are brought back from Napoleon's last residence on St. Helena Island. Historians say his belongings have sparked the passion of collectors in France and other parts of the world. Several years ago, one of the French emperor's signature bicorn hats was sold to a Korean food industry mogul for more than $2 million. A Belgian chocolate maker has come up with the idea of chocolate bunnies in the shape of vaccine syringes to spread hope during the coronavirus pandemic. Geneviève Trapon makes the chocolate bunnies at her workshop in a village south of Brussels. She has dubbed the chocolate syringes Lache à Aztec. I hope I pronounced that correctly. This is not the first time the Belgian confectioner has been inspired by the pandemic to create art. Last year, she also put white masks on its Easter bunnies to keep the spirit alive amid a worsening pandemic. Trapon says she came up with the idea of syringe-shaped bunnies after the first coronavirus inoculations in her country at the end of 2020.
Why did I decide to create the chocolate vaccine? We are still in a period of COVID-19, and it was the logical continuation of the little masked rabbit from last year. Back then, nobody was talking about vaccines. At the end of that year, we started talking about a vaccine, and I thought the rabbit should be vaccinated. It's a symbol of hope, and that's why I decided to create the vaccine.
Trapon says her works show natural health benefits of chocolate. She believes that the chocolate version, like a real vaccine, has enough positive effects such as anti-depression, nutrients, and magnesium. Many of us have missed air traveling, though, due to the coronavirus pandemic. Now, a South Korean airline has opened a restaurant offering in-flight meals on land. The Jeju Air restaurant resembles being in a flight with mock plane windows and boarding gates. It serves popular onboard meals such as rice and chicken. Customers have hailed the creative idea, saying the experience reminds them of the joy of travel. Having food in the imaginary flight costs around $9 for each person. The temporary diner will run for the next 3 months. Let's go to the Philippines to meet a man having a big, colorful collection of Happy Meal toys. Percival Lorg has been into collecting toys since he was five. His collection includes around 20,000 toys from fast food restaurant chains like McDonald's and Burger King. Lorg also holds a Guinness World Record from 2014. The 50-year-old graphic artist says he always takes good care of his beloved toys. He believes each toy has a story inside.
Toy is like a storyteller in itself. Like, for example, it gives me a glimpse of that particular period when I got it, my story, what's going on, what are the incidents that are attached in the acquisition of that particular toy.
Lorg says his family and friends also help him broaden his collection by donating toys. He hopes to display his toy collection for the public to, quote, give people a chance to revisit their childhood memories.
People around the world have been grounded by the coronavirus, with many being forced to work from home. But the Scottishman has made his secluded cliffside a perfect spot against a pandemic-induced change to working habits. Jason Griffin's 34-year-old call center consultant from Glasgow has put remote working technology to the test by moving his office to a dangling shelf off the Irish Sea. His move is seen as an attempt to give rise to the digital nomad, meaning people can use technology to work from wherever connectivity is possible. Griffin says as long as there is a mobile connection and his laptop, he has everything he needs to do his job.
Today we are pushing the technology to its limits because we're going over a cliff face, we're abseiling down to a ledge, and I will be working all day from that ledge and taking and making calls, interacting with internal staff, just showing that remote literally means remote.
Griffins has set up a temporary office on a cliff face to prove that its performance is as good as a busy office. Call centers are one sector where remote working and technology has kept companies connected to customers. But the digital revolution has seen an inclination towards working remotely. The pink supermoon has glowed over different landmarks all over the world. The phenomenon lit up the sky in different countries from Greece to China on Tuesday night. The supermoon occurs when a full moon is closer to Earth than usual and therefore appears bigger and brighter in the sky. The term was first coined by an American astrologer in 1979. When the supermoon rises in April, it's called a pink supermoon after a pink wildflower that blooms in the eastern parts of North America. According to NASA, the next supermoon will come in less than a month on May 26th.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Large chocolate reproduction of Picasso's iconic painting of Guernica has gone on display in the Basque country town. A steady stream of residents has visited the artistic work created by 40 Basque chocolatiers. The work of art is expected to stay in Guernica until it tours different Spanish and European cities. The move marks the 84th anniversary of the bombing of Guernica in northern Spain by Nazi Germany. Picasso painted Guernica to portray the suffering of people and animals wrought by violence and chaos. Upon completion, Guernica was put on display at a Paris exposition in 1937. Lebanon has unveiled its first indigenously produced electric car, which is also the first ever car manufactured in the country. The red sports car Quds Rise is named after the Palestinian holy city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, which remains under Israel's occupation. The car is adorned at the front with a golden logo of the Dome of the Rock, signifying the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. It's the project of Lebanese-born Palestinian businessman Jihad Mohammed.
We have two sources of electricity. There is the state's electricity that are the generators, so we pay to 10 recharging stations, and we are looking for secure places to install them.
The company hopes to start the production of up to 10,000 units of his electric sports car in Lebanon later this year. Jihad Mohammed says his long-term goal is to compete on international markets for hybrid and electric cars, as well as to make sales in Lebanon. In a remote part of Pakistan, two sisters have come up with a unique idea to help children continue their education during pandemic-related school closures: a camel library. The mobile library visits four villages in Pakistan's largest province of Balochistan. Children borrow books and return them the next time the camel visits. The project was founded by a local high school principal and his sister. Rahima Jalal says she started the project because she wanted children around her remote hometown to continue learning despite schools being closed.
When the coronavirus spread, the entire region and all the schools were closed. There was an atmosphere of depression for old and young alike. The region where I live, there is no entertainment for children at all, no place for outings. The only activity is the children going to school and coming back home. After the schools had remained closed for 8 or 9 months due to COVID, we started wondering what we could do for the children. How could we start some sort of activity which would keep children busy and also be of some benefit to them?
Pakistan closed the schools early in 2020 due to the coronavirus pandemic and sent some 50 million school and university students home. The closures put children in Balochistan at particular risk of falling behind, as the province is Pakistan's most impoverished. Even though some schools have reopened, children in this region still have trouble accessing educational resources. NASA's Ingenuity Mars helicopter has successfully completed its third flight on the red planet while moving farther and faster than ever before. It was nothing short of amazing, says the Ingenuity Projects program executive. The drone covered 50 meters of distance, reaching the speed of nearly 2 meters per second. In its latest flight, the helicopter filmed 80 seconds of video, which are to be sent to Earth in the coming days. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration says similar flights are yet to come, with each planned to be of increasing difficulty in order to push Ingenuity to its limits. The experiment will end in 1 month in order to let Perseverance return to its main task, searching for signs of past microbial life on Mars.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
The Month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. In the last 10 days of this month, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, used to get prepared for further worship.
It is narrated that he paid a special attention to i'tikaf in the blessed month of Ramadan. He would adhere to this tradition in every Ramadan, but in the year that the Battle of Badr took place, he couldn't do this as the war was in the month of Ramadan. Therefore, the Prophet performed i'tikaf for 20 days to compensate for the year before. As you know, the pilgrims of the symbolic house of God in Mecca, Kaaba, have to refrain from certain things when they want to enter the sacred mosque. When they wear the special garb, ihram, more than 20 things become forbidden for them. Ramadan is similar to Hajj, as certain things become forbidden for the person who fasts. The fourth infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, says, Almighty God has made the month of Ramadan superior to other months with ample respects and famous virtues. Thus, a series of things that were halal in other months have been forbidden for reverence and respect of this month. And he has prohibited eating and drinking in this month for ennoblement of Ramadan. Dear listeners, no doubt, a person who stays in a mosque for i'tikaf in Ramadan will be more favored by God. According to the Islamic jurisprudence, material and financial atonement of fasting should be given to the poor. This can be given to poor relatives, but is forbidden to give it to one's family members who receive alimony. If the atonement is paid as money, it should be paid to charity institutions to buy food and give to poor people. The money for atonement cannot be spent for other uses such as cultural and social uses. The money shouldn't be less than the price of 750 grams of wheat. A patient who suffers from a chronic disease and cannot fast till the end of Ramadan or the next Ramadan, fasting as compensation is not obligatory for him, but he has to give 750 grams of wheat or rice and so on for each day. Dear friends, as we have said earlier, on the eve of the 19th of the blessed month of Ramadan in 40 AH, the renegade Abdurrahman ibn Muljam struck Imam Ali's head with a poisonous sword while the Imam was in mihrab, that is the niche of the Mosque of Kufa. Imam Ali, peace upon him, was so dear for the Prophet of Islam and enjoyed such a lofty position with God that the Prophet would benefit any opportunity to inform people of his status. Once, he said to Imam Ali, You are to me like Aaron to Moses, except that there will be no messenger after me. This hadith proves all merits of Aaron for Imam Ali, except that there won't be any messenger after Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The Prophet used to emphasize that Imam Ali would be the next leader of the Ummah after him. He said time and again that Imam Ali had been designated by God as the Prophet's vicegerent and the first Imam of the Ummah. Let us place God on oath by the lofty status of Imam Ali on these nights to forgive our sins and help us follow the Prophet and his Ahlul Bayt, his infallible progeny, peace upon them. Now let us recite a supplication that has been recommended for the eve of the 21st of the blessed month of Ramadan. O inserter of the night in the day and inserter of the day in the night, and bringer of the living out of the dead, and bringer of the dead out of the living. O provider of whomever you want without reckoning. O God, O compassionate. O God, O merciful. O God, O God, O God. You have the best names and lofty comparisons and grandeurs and bounties. I plead to you to bless Muhammad and progeny of Muhammad, and place my name on this night among the successful, and my spirit among the martyrs, and my good deed among the inhabitants of the highest point of paradise, and forgive my evil deeds, and I plead to you to grant me certitude, which accompanies with my heart, and faith, which takes doubt away from me, and make me satisfied with what you have distributed for me, and give us good in the world and good in the hereafter, and guard us against the punishment of burning fire, and give me a sustenance on this night, your remembrance and your gratitude, an enthusiasm toward you and returning to you, and assisting me in what you have assisted Muhammad and progeny of Muhammad. Greetings to him and them. The subcontinent.
Hi everyone, this is Don, and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region of South Asia as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about India's nascent alliance called Quad with Japan and Australia, as well as the United States, and its impact on geopolitics of the Indo-Pacific region. And we shall also take a look at the recent rise of Maoist attacks in India and the prospects of peace for the decades-old insurgency.
Some call it the Asian NATO, but many believe this is a misnomer. The Quad is a combination of a couple of trilateral ties with India or US at the center that is now shaping